On this episode of Innovation Ambassadors, we're showcasing the journey of Manchester Airports Group, the UK's largest airport group that's transforming the travel experience for their customers with innovation at its core. Discover how they're teaming with AWS prototyping, using generative AI and serverless technologies to deliver faster, smarter airport experiences. Well, I'm excited to welcome John Hudson, Chief Technology Officer of Manchester Airports Group. John, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us from Manchester Airports Group, we have Alex Whitehorn, Senior Software Engineer. Great to have you here, Alex.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
And from our AWS prototyping team, we have Val Cohen, Senior Prototyping Engineer. Always great to chat with you, Val.
Great to chat with you as well, Sarah. Really excited to be here today.
So, John, for our international listeners, can you tell us a little bit about Manchester Airports Group?
Yeah, so we are the UK's largest airport group, owning and operating Manchester, London, Stansted, and East Midlands airports. We've also got a digital travel service, a company called Kavu, who do things like fast track, lounge access, car parking. So we're kind of a full suite offering. Last year, as the group, we served around 60 million passengers to about 261 destinations. That's across our three airports. And a nice little stat that I like to tell people is that at least 70% of the UK is within a two-hour drive of any one of our airports. So we are really well placed across the UK to serve everywhere, not just one small area of the country. And across the group, we employ about 5,800 or so people.
Fantastic. And serving passengers throughout the world, really.
Yeah, so we've got flights through from the Middle East across to the west coast of the US. We serve a lot in Europe as well. Yeah, we travel to, yeah, all over the world.
Fantastic. And tell us a little bit about what it's like to be the CTO of an airports group. What are some of the challenges that you have and some of the technology that you're trying to bring to solve that?
Yeah, I think I see my role as a bit of a facilitator. I'm not hands on keyboards anymore. For me, it's about understanding the technology landscape of what's going on in the world. Obviously, AI, as we'll chat about later on, is really big. And that's changing quite a lot. But yeah, kind of all technology, I try to keep abreast of what's changing. And then working with the wider business, to understand the business strategic goals. So whether that's trying to improve our sustainability, whether it's trying to increase revenue, increase the number of passengers, increase our customer experience. It's about understanding what the business wants and what role technology can play in that, and how we can then create products and services and applications to actually further those strategic goals.
And when you think about your customers, it's more than just passengers, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So I think anyone who lands on a plane and comes to the airport to take off, they are passengers for sure. But we have, if you think about taxi drivers showing up and kind of using our car parks, they're customers too, but they're not passengers. We have train stations, bus stations, and coach stations. We have office plots where I work. I'm a customer here because I can go out and buy lunch within the airport. I'm not specifically a passenger, so our customers are much wider than just the people flying on planes.
You described airports as mini cities.
Yeah, so for me, if you look at some of the things I mentioned there, so all of the different transport hubs we have, whether it's at any of our airports, so just not just the car parking, but bus, tram, train, taxi ranks. We have office blocks, police stations, fire stations, multiple data centers on site. We have like a logistics plant with all the baggage in the kind of the belly of the airports. We have food and beverage and retail and supermarkets. We have the airfield as well. So it's like a mini city. What's really interesting is when we want to try something and we're innovating, we can put that tech out and you get to try it on the scale of a mini city. So it's really, really exciting to do.
Right. Absolutely. And maybe talk to us a little bit about what you were trying to achieve with the experience that you had with AWS.
Yeah. So we did a bit of strategic work around customer experience. And one of the things that kind of came back from that was that we have a lot of information, but it's kind of sporadic and kind of all over the place in different formats, different mediums. So yeah, we one of the phrases we use quite a lot at the minute is that we are data rich but insight poor. So for us, it's about going out and getting that information. So whether it's flight information on the display screens, security queue times on a different screen, physical maps to show where prayer rooms or water fountains or toilets are, and to bring all that information into a centralized location so we can put it in front of our customers and make it a lot easier. Now, the problem statement that we come out of this, and that whenever we start a project, it's not about solutionizing, it's about that, what the problem is. Mm-hmm. So that we have some information kiosks that are staffed right now in our three airports, but they're not staffed 24/7. When they are staffed, it can be really busy peak time, so it can take a long time to get to the front of the queue. And even if there's no queue, you can walk up, and if the person behind the kiosk doesn't speak the same language as you, then it's no use. So as an example of that, we get a lot of Italian speakers traveling through Stansted at a weekend. So for us, it was about, we needed to create something that brought all the information together in a single source of truth. It was available 24/7, 365 in multiple languages. They were the three kind of main key points we were looking for a solution to solve.
Fantastic. And Alex, I'll bring you in. You're a senior software engineer, so responsible for the actually building out the systems, right? Can you tell us a little bit about the technology estate there at Manchester Airports Group and give us a little bit of a lay of the land?
Yeah, so we're very highly invested in AWS. So one of the great things that when we worked with the prototyping team that they were able to do was make sure that the new novel technologies that we'd be working with, the LLM core of this system, fit in with our existing workflows and technologies. So for this solution, the virtual assistant that John mentioned, we're calling it VAL as a working name, which is a backronym for Virtual Airport Liaison. Because the main ask is to be an information aggregator from multiple disparate sources, we decided to build this with a large language model at its core. And as I said, the prototyping team really helped us fit in that novel cutting edge LLM aspect into existing workflows and technologies that we're familiar with. Meaning that once me and Faz, the other engineer working on this, have finished and productionized it, other engineers from across the team should be able to come and help out on various systems because it's known to us.
Right, right. So how did you come to work with VAL, the VAL in person and the prototyping team?
Wasn't actually my decision. It was made over my head. I mean that respectfully. Might be best for John, that one.
John?
Yes. So for me, part of working with AWS and the prototyping team was about build with, not build for. We could go out to the market and get someone to come and build us this, but it doesn't provide much value other than the product you get. If you want to build on top of it and do something else, you're going to have to go out and pay more money to do that again. Whereas for me, I saw it as a really good opportunity to not only get a product at the end of it, but take someone like Alex, who's just a really innovative, and then Faz, who's recently graduated from associate to midway engineer. It was a really good opportunity for her to come onto the project and kind of show the skills she's got. So kind of taking two people at different levels of the career, different thinkers as well, and kind of train them up and get them the skills. So by the end of the project, so this is the first part of this was a 6-week stint with the prototyping team. Not only would we have that kind of proof of concept out of it, that prototype, we would have two engineers that know what they're doing and can further that and bring those skills to MAG, and we could do more with it.
Fantastic. You know, Val, that is absolutely part of the core of prototyping and how we set prototyping up at AWS is that experiential approach, that build with. Tell us a little bit about those first meetings, how you came to decide what would be done in that 6-week period.
Yeah. So the first time that I really started working with the Manchester Airports Group or MAG was through a kickoff workshop, just a couple hours on a Friday at the AWS office, where we sat with them and really understood what's the problem that they're facing. Now, I, like probably many of you, have gone through an airport, so a lot of the problems that they talked about were really easy for me to understand. As a Londoner, I've actually traveled through Stansted, which is one of the MAG airports, many, many times. So it was really cool to hear a business side of a problem that I encounter as a customer. So during that conversation, we learned about some of the challenges that John's talked about, and also John's vision for the future, as well as the company's vision for the future. And I think one of the things that's really cool about prototyping and these conversations in general is not only do we figure out what do we want at the end of the prototype, but we also create a safe space where various folks from MAG and even from the account team can really throw out ideas that are maybe not relevant for the prototype, but really cool and interesting things to think about for future projects and awesome ideas for things to work on later down the line. Specific to the prototype, we were able to figure out what is the end goal for the 4 weeks of building that we had. We have to scope it down. We can't do everything in just 4 weeks. So really, what is the core of the problem? And for this, the really big piece of what MAG wanted us to build was a system or an application that could use a large language model to perform various functions and answer various user questions. So through the conversation with John, we learned about what kinds of questions those customers might have. And we thought about how can we use LLMs and Gen AI technology to answer those questions. So off the bat, we knew we were going to be using tools, which is basically how LLMs can interact with different systems or data or other applications, and agents, which is how LLMs decide which of those to use at a different time. We also knew that we were going to have kind of a standard web application architecture, and we tried to mimic as closely to the MAG one as we could. Through that initial whiteboarding session, we came up with an architecture that actually wound up being extremely similar to the architecture we wound up with at the end of the prototype. And not to say that those architectures don't change as we go along, because definitely pieces of it do and have as well in the past in other prototypes I've worked on. But it's really cool to see how much of that decision-making process happens when you just put everyone in a room together and just figure out what do we want this to look like at the end, instead of trying to divvy up tasks as you go or figure out how we're going to do it. We just see what do we want this to look like at the end, and how do we kind of at a high level think we're going to get there. And then it's awesome that John left it up to Alex and Faz and myself from the prototyping team to be able to actually build and make that vision a reality.
Mm-hmm. And John, that collaborative approach and working backwards from your customers and those multiple different personas of your customers, so important for you to realize your vision.
Yeah, like you say, for us, it's yes, we want to be able to get people through the airport quicker. Sometimes I refer to us as a logistics company. We move people, bags, and planes. Mm. And each one of those is just as important as the other, because the plane can't take off without the people or the bags. So it's for us, it's about if we can understand the pain points of the customers, then therefore we can serve them better. So for me, and I've talked about this, the end goal for me with this service, with Val, the digital Val, is to not need it anymore, so that we can, what I mean by that is that if a customer's coming up and a lot of customers are asking for the water fountains, well, we can take that insight, that's because we're going to be storing all of the data, all of the questions, all of the answers. So we can see that, okay, customers need more water fountains. They need better directions to them, so we can put up physical signs. And then so we fix that, and then the next problem starts occurring, and we fix that, and the next one, people start asking for McDonald's, and we don't have a McDonald's in the airport. We install a McDonald's. So by the end of it, we should have solved every single problem, and we don't need the kiosks anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm a pragmatist. That's never going to happen. There's always going to be something else that we can physically be doing, we can learn from. But I think from that kind of macro approach, we're not only putting information in front of the customers, we're creating a single source of truth where they can speak to it in their own language and ask their own questions. And we can take that, and we can, again, we can use AI on top of that to give us the biggest questions, topics that have been asked, and do something about it. So it's a win-win for me.
Right. Absolutely. So Alex, I understand you are incredibly important, a part of the development of the prototype. Can you talk us through a little bit of the architecture and some of the patterns that you used?
Sure. So Val again, the system VAL is deployed on serverless functions in the AWS cloud, which means Lambda functions. So the reason we picked those was that they're serverless and scalable. So we as engineers don't need to worry about setting up or provisioning environments or worrying about throughput. These things can scale up and down as needed to serve as much or as little traffic and then charge us accordingly. In front of the functions, we've got CloudFront, which is AWS's content distribution network. And we use that for high availability. So when our front-end clients talk to this system, it's always going to be available. Behind that, we've got a WAF or a web application firewall, which ensures two really main things. One is throughput. So if people are absolutely spamming this thing in the terminals, the WAF can start to slow things down a bit and make sure that we don't get billed too much money. The next one is ensuring that only pre-authorized clients can talk to this system. So if somehow someone got their hands on the public URL for this, they're not behind the firewall, so they wouldn't be able to talk to it. The exciting bit of this is what the Lambda functions actually do, which is they make requests to AWS Bedrock, which serves the large language models for us. So the good thing about Bedrock is that we don't have to worry about the expensive and risky business of training large language models from scratch. We can use pre-trained foundational models by companies like Anthropic, whose Claude product we're actually using for the system now, and then provided by AWS. So we send off the user question to Bedrock, get the answer back. Another thing the Lambdas do, while wrapping Bedrock, they use open source tools such as LangChain, which Val touched on briefly. These provide us the large language model agent, which is the decision-making core of the system. We give this tools which wrap our data sources. So an example of a tool would be a function that looks up flight information for a certain day. If a user scans their boarding card, we can look at their flight date, their flight ID, and then go and look up the flight status from that. The virtual assistant agent can then use these tools to figure out how best to answer the user's question by aggregating the flight information, the weather, the currency, content updates from our website. The agent aggregates all of that, returns the answer to that user. Finally, there's our backend, which is a DynamoDB store of chat history, which means that the system is context aware. So if a user says, "What time is my flight?" the system says, "I don't know what flight you mean. Could you give me some more data?" And then when the user gives the system their flight ID, it knows what the user wants to do with the flight ID because they've already said that in a previous message. So we use DynamoDB as a facilitator for chat history.
Nice. And then are you also using that for the insights that John
talked
about?
That's right. Yeah. So for security reasons, we have a time to live on the on DynamoDB, meaning that a chat session only lasts for at most a couple of hours. Then it's automatically archived in a cheaper database where we can go and analyze that downstream.
Right.
What's really key about that data as well is that we're not going to be storing any personal identifiable information, any PII. So what Alex and the team did was obfuscate any of that. So I could tell them my name and where I live and ask about my flight ID, and it would come back and it would just all be out, like blocked out in the data apart from that. So we get a lot of freedom of information requests. People can ask for it, but we won't be able to recognize who said what. So we don't need to know it for our insights. So there's no need for us to store it. So for us, data protection is a really big thing.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when we talk about experimentation and innovation and iterating, especially with new technology, we often talk at Amazon about invention and failure as inseparable twins. That you can't, it's not an experiment if you know exactly what's going to happen. Were there areas here that we had some challenges that we had to overcome?
Yeah, so I think my definition of success is learning something. Mm-hmm. So for me, that if you design something and you spend months building it out, if your definition of success is building exactly what you designed on that first day, 99% of the time you're going to fail. Things change. So for me, it's about learning it. If this project, we learned that it was too expensive, we didn't have the skills, we didn't have the time, so that it would be better to either not do it or purchase it off the shelf, then cool, that's a success because we've learned something to get something that will further those strategic goals. Thankfully, it didn't, and I think it was the opposite side of this. We had we were almost a victim of our own success in that the test kiosk, which I can kind of see across the office in front of me, that has all of this on, got so many eyes in it. People were so impressed by it and its abilities that when we looked at kind of our go, no-go decision, we decided not to go because there were so many people saying, oh, I think it could do this and I think it could do that. We wanted to have the best impression in front of customers. So in one sense, it was a success because people are on board. In another sense, it's a failure because we haven't managed to get it out yet and we've had to slow that kind of agile, fail-fast mentality down slightly. But I say overall it's a success, but I'll take success if the business is behind it.
Right. Always that balance between getting something in the hands of customers so you can iterate on their actual feedback and making sure that it has that minimal lovable capabilities, right? So that people will actually use it, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And on the technical side, Val, I understand there are also some challenges. Is that right?
Yes, definitely. As there always are during prototypes, right? They never go exactly as expected and things tend to change a lot from, week to week. So one of the challenges we saw during this prototype was, as John mentioned earlier, supporting multiple languages is one of the requirements of the system. John mentioned they have a lot of passengers from a lot of different places. I think it's common for them to get Italian passengers in Stansted. So making sure the application can support multiple languages was a big must for the team. That being said, we don't have anyone who speaks Italian on the team. The best we had was human Val, me. I speak Spanish at the equivalent of like a sixth grader, maybe, on a good day. My grammar is questionable, but other than that, I can generally understand what things are saying and can speak it okay. So I was interacting with the LLMs in Spanish to try to test whether the system could actually handle different languages. And what I was noticing through this testing when I was initially doing it is when I was asking questions in Spanish, no matter what question I asked, whether it was what lounges were available in the airport or information about a flight, we were still only getting information about parking passes. And we were trying to figure out why that was. And I actually went into the logs, looked at the debugging, and it was an issue with the semantic search. And when I looked really closely at the data that was being pulled from the semantic search, it was all the Spanish data about the parking passes. So Alex and I figured out that there's actually content in the MAG website, which is what we were using for the data source, that's in Spanish about the parking passes. And so no matter what question we were asking, it was always returning this information. And what I realized was that this was happening because the system was over-indexing on language. So instead of searching for things that were semantically similar, so instead of maybe lounges available at the airport, it's lounges within Stansted or something like that. It was just searching, really prioritizing the fact that it was in Spanish. So it was always returning the content in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And so what we wound up doing just for the prototype was we just deleted that data from the data source to ensure that it would focus on the other, semantic similarities. So it's a vector space. We wanted to not focus as much on the language index and focus more on other similarities within the vector space. So that was what we did for the prototype. And I think, Alex, you guys have made a different decision for the production system to support multiple languages, right?
Yeah. It just speaks to how quickly prototypes like this evolve and how agile they have to be. What we ended up doing was that we realized it doesn't matter what languages the large language model speaks if you put the translate layer in front of the entire system. So what we ended up doing was using Amazon Translate to translate the user's question from the source language, call it Italian, translates that into English, and then passes that question on to the system, which then responds again in English. We call back to Amazon Translate to translate that back into Italian and then give that back to the user. So the system's got the illusion of being able to speak pretty much any language, right? It's all the ones that Amazon Translate speaks, but we only ever have to deal with English on the back end.
And the beauty of that for me is that one of the things we hadn't really thought about was that we'd always contemplated languages. We know we're going to need it people to be able to speak multiple languages. We know what we want to store all of the responses and the questions so that we can get the insights out of it. We hadn't contemplated or thought about that if you are speaking Italian, it will store it in Italian, then we have data in a language that none of us speak. Right. So what we did then was what we would realize this means that everything will store in English. It'll store with the spoken language as well, so we can see, look for anomalies. So if we're getting weird answers back for certain questions, it might be because the translation's a bit wrong. But it means that we have everything in a single language. So it's just a happy little accident on that. But yeah, it was a really good one.
Nice. And John, you mentioned that being a victim of your own success and sometimes having that feature paralysis there of what are you going to actually constitute in your minimal lovable product. Where are we now in terms of that, getting Val, the electronic Val in your airports?
So yeah, after the initial piece with the AWS prototyping team, Alex and Faz had learned so much. We wanted to make sure they could stick on the project to keep learning. We weren't fully in a place where we felt we could take it on ourselves. We still needed some assistance with that. And that's where we worked with AWS ProServe. So bringing in the professional services team who could understand where we're at. Again, understand our current architecture. Like Alex said, we didn't want someone who would come and rip up what we'd done or change the way we want to do everything. They took where we were at. They understood where we were at in terms of how our wider architecture works, and helped us build that out from a prototype through to a full MVP, which is a bit of an oxymoron if you say a full MVP, but still. So we're at that stage now where we've got the MVP, we've put a lot more on it, and we're getting to the point where in the next few weeks or months it's going to be put out into the public. I think what they've really helped us work on is guardrails and the security side of it, which I know Alex has worked on a lot, so I'll leave that to you to speak to the technicalities.
Sure, yeah, so guardrails are a really important part of getting from prototype to production. Because this is a customer-facing system, we obviously want it to only speak about certain topics and to avoid certain topics. We actually did a prototype of this during the POC phase with Val, which again, I keep going on about how quickly things change. This is another example. At the time of the prototype, the dumb thing was to use open source libraries to implement guardrails. Sort of top of the pack at the time was NVIDIA's Nemo guardrails. Since we did that, Bedrock itself has provided a guardrail system that was in preview during the prototype, but is now generally available. And Bedrock provides the concept of an allow list and a deny list for topics. So we can restrict the subject of conversation to exactly what we want users to talk about. Another important aspect of that is I don't want to say tone policing, but restricting the tone of users' messages. So some obvious things that we don't want users to talk about are profanity, violent content, things of a sexual nature. So because of that deny list, we can stop the system from talking about those. And that's both in and out. So not only can users not get such content to reach our large language models, in the extremely unlikely event that the model returns something that fulfills one of those criteria, it won't make its way to the user either. It'll be blocked before then, and a much more user-friendly message presented.
Well, so important too, right? You talked about the pace of innovation, John. So important as we look at integrating new technology into the business and into our lives, that we're making use of those guardrails and ensuring, as you mentioned before, that secure and ethical use of technology.
So for me, looking at the testing side of it's important. Having someone like Alex on it who is, I'm going to make him blush a bit, but Alex is a real ethical thinker. He's a very, very smart guy. And I know that everything Alex does, he puts thought behind it. He's not just going to do something because it's cool, or he's going to do the right thing to solve the problem. So for me, it was about having the right people on it in order to, yeah, kind of look at those, the guardrails, the moral and ethical side of what we're building as well.
And one thing to add about testing that's really interesting is it's a really new experience of blending the business with technology. So in order for Alex to do all the testing and write, you know, however many test cases, Alex needs to understand the answer to a bunch of different questions that are going to be asked of the system, which means that Alex, who is a senior software engineer, now has to learn a lot about the Manchester Airport Group operations and their website. And, you know, Alex and I and Faz can probably all tell you everything about all the lounges in the Manchester Airport because we've asked so many times of the system. And so it's really cool to see the folks from technology and the folks from the business side having to work together to accomplish a goal in a way that really hasn't been done before in other technology areas.
Really interesting and very valuable for your end customers as well. The closer we can get to our end customers, the better we can serve them, right? Well, John, Alex, and Val, thank you so much for being here today and sharing your journey with us in bringing new technologies to Manchester Airports Group's customers. And I'll just leave it with some reflections. Val, I'll start with you. You know, what would you share with someone who's on a similar journey for their customers?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I noticed as Alex and Faz and I were starting to work together is that one of the best ways to learn the concepts of working with LLMs and using generative AI is to just build it. There's so many different choices out there. There's so many different technologies that you use. With a lot of these options, it's really easy to change from one model to another, to change from one vector database to another, especially if you start with a small data set. So for me, one of the biggest pieces of advice that I can give to customers is to get started and build something today. Even if it's just in, you know, a Jupyter notebook so that you can show that you understand how it works, doing it and looking through the logs and things like that and understanding how you're getting from A to B with these systems is going to be really helpful. And then you can start going through all the problems and figuring out which, you know, model's best for me and which of these should I experiment with? Because there's so many different experiments that you can run that it's tempting to just start and try to boil the ocean. So really just pick something and go with it. And then you'll probably change a lot of the different components of it, but you'll understand the underlying concepts. And that's the most important part.
Spoken like a true prototyping engineer, huh? Alex, how about you?
That segues quite nicely into my recommendations. I've got two. The first is document everything you do so that you know in retrospect what was a one-way door decision and what was a two-way door decision. If you know what you did and why, it's easier to change it in the future. And the other one is make sure that everything you do is replicable. It's the nature of prototypes and proofs of concept that you have to change a lot of stuff really quickly and break it, right? So if you can make sure that it's replicable, you can spin things back up to where they were at a known working point, you'll be golden. So infrastructure as code.
Nice. Spoken like a true software engineer. Okay. John, final words for you.
Yeah. I think that the pace of change in technology at the minute, especially with AI, is lightning fast. And the chances of you having the right person with the right knowledge at the right time, you're not always going to have them. So it's about working with partners. Again, I'm not trying to sell AWS specifically here. I'm giving you my opinion on how it worked for us. That Alex and Faz have spent, 13 weeks full-time working in AI with LLMs. And now they are fairly fluent in it and they can go away. And if we wanted to create a new one for something else, they could do that. So for me, it's about, you don't have to know all the right information. You need to find a partner that does, and they can share that information with you and help you along that path. Say 13 weeks is what most people spend in a bootcamp to learn to code from scratch. And some people come out of that fantastic. So I think for me, in what was a, we've got a product out of it. We've got what we paid for, and we've got the extra, the value add in that I've got a team now who can do it. So yeah, finding people who know what they're doing and can help you along that path has paid dividends for us massively.
Wonderful to hear. Well, John, Alex, Val, thanks so much again.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for having us.